Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman, Part 2, picking up on page 37. Of others, I have not been able to procure confirmation owing to ignorancy of the address of those conversant with the facts. I find among her papers, many of which are defaced by being carried about with her for years, portions of letters addressed to myself by persons at the South, and speaking of the valuable assistance Harriet was rendering our soldiers in the hospital and our armies in the field. At this time, her manner of life, as related by herself, was this: "Well, missus, I go to D Hospital. I would early rebring a morning. I get a big chunk of ice, I would, and bring it into a basin and fill it with water. Then I take a sponge and begin. Fust a man I come to, I thrust away the flies and de rise de wood like bees round the hive. Then I begin to bathe the wounds, and by the time I bathed off three or four, the fire and heat would have melted the ice and made the water warm, and it would be as red as clear blood. Then I go get more ice. I would, by the time I got to the next one, the flies would be round about fussing, one black and thick as ember. In this way she worked day after day, till late at night. Then she went home to her little cabin and made about 50 pies, a great quantity of gingerbread, and 2 casks of root beer. These she would hire some contraband to sell for her through the camps, and thus she would provide her support for another day. For this woman never received pay or pension, and never drew for herself but 20 days' rations during the 4 years of her labors. At one time, she was called away from Hilton Head by one of our officers to come to Fernandina, where men were dying off like sheep from dysentery. Harriet was acquired quite a reputation for her skill in curing this disease by a medicine which she prepared from roots, which grew near the waters which gave the disease. Here she found thousands of sick soldiers and contrabands, and immediately gave up her time and attention to them. At another time, we find her nursing those who were down by hundreds of smallpox and malignant fevers. She had never had these diseases, but she seems to have no more fear of death in one form than another. The Lord would take care of her till her time came, and then she was ready to go. When our armies and gunboats first appeared in any part of the South, many of the poor Negroes were as much afraid of the Yankee rhetoric as of their own masters. It was almost impossible to win over their confidence or to get information from them, but to Harriet they would tell anything, and so it became quite important that she should accompany expeditions going up the rivers or into unexplored parts of the country to control and get information from those whom they took with them as guides. General Hunter asked her at one time if she would go with several gunboats up the Combahee River, the object of the expedition being to take up the torpedoes placed by the rebels in the river to destroy railroads and bridges and to cut off supplies from the rebel troops. She said she would go if Colonel Montgomery was to be appointed commander of the expedition. Colonel Montgomery was one of John Brown's men and was well known to Harriet. Accordingly, Colonel Montgomery was appointed to the command, and Harriet with several men under her, the principal of whom was J. Plowden, whose pass I have, accompanied the expedition. Harriet describes in the most graphic manner the appearance of the plantations as they passed up the river, the frightened Negroes leaving their work and taking to the woods at the sight of the gunboats, then coming to peer out like startled deer and scuttling away like the wind at the sound of the steam whistle. "Well," said one old Negro, "master said the Yankees have horns and tails, but I never believe it till now." But the word was passed along by the mysterious telegraphic communication existing among these simple people that these were Lincoln's gunboats come to set them free. In vain, then, the drivers used their whips in their efforts to hurry the poor creatures back to their quarters. They all turned and ran for the gunboats. They came down every road, across every field, just as they had left their work and their cabin, women with children, clinging around their necks, hanging to their dresses, running behind, all making at full speed for Lincoln's gunboats. 800 poor wretches at one time crowded the banks, with their hands extended towards the deliverers, and they were all taken off upon the gunboats and carried down to Beaufort. "I never see such a sight," said Harriet. "We laughed and laughed and laughed. Here you'd see a woman with a pail on her head, rice smoking in it just as she'd taken it from the fire, young one hanging on behind, one hand round her forehead to hold on, together hang digging in the rice pot, eating wild, with all its might, hold on her dress two or three more, down her back a bag with a pig in it. One woman brought two pigs, a white one and a black one. We took them on board, named the white pig Beauregat, and the black pig Jeff Davis. Sometimes the women would come with twins hanging round her necks, pairs like I never see so many twins in my life, bags under shoulders, baskets under heads, and young ones tagging behind, all loaded, pigs squealing, chickens screaming, young ones squalling. And so they came pouring down to the gunboats. When they stood on the shore and the small boats put out to take them off, they all wanted to get in at once. After the boats were crowded, they would hold on to them so that they could not leave the shore. The oarsmen would beat them on their hands, but they would not let go. They were afraid the gunboats would go off and leave them, and all wanted to make sure of one of these arks of refuge. At length, Colonel Montgomery shouted from the upper deck above the clamor of appealing tones, "Moses, you'll have to get him a song." Then Harriet lifted up her voice and sang, "Of all the whole creatures in the east or in the west, the glorious Yankee nation is the greatest and the best. Come along, come along, don't be alarmed. Uncle Sam is rich enough to give you all a farm." At the end of every verse, the Negroes in their enthusiasm would throw up their hands and shout glory, and the rowboats would take that opportunity to push off. And so at last they were all brought on board. The masters fled. Houses and barns, railroad bridges were burned, tacks torn up, torpedoes destroyed, and the expedition was in all respects successful. This fearless woman was often sent into the rebel lines as a spy and brought back very valuable information as to the position of the armies and batteries. She has been in battle when the shot was falling like hail and the bodies of dead and wounded men were dropping around her like leaves in autumn. But the thought of fear never seems to have had a place for a moment in her mind. She had her duty to perform, and she expected to take care of it till it was done. Would that instead of taking them in this poor way at second hand, my readers could hear this woman's graphic accounts of scenes she herself witnessed, could listen to her imitations of Negro preachers in their own very peculiar dialect, her singing of camp meeting hymns, her accounts of experience meetings, her imitations of the dances and the funeral ceremonies of these simple people. Why, the language Dandar is this far south is just as different for miles and million as you can think, she said. They laughed when they heard me talk to, and could not understand and know how. She described a midnight funeral which she attended for the slaves never having been allowed to bury their dead in the daytime, continue the custom of night funerals from habit. The corpse was laid upon the ground, and the people all sat around, the group being lighted up by pine torches. The old Negro preacher began by giving out a hymn, which was sung by all. "And oh, I wish you could hear him sing, Masses," said Harriet. "Their voice is so sweet, and they can sing everything we sing, and then they can sing a great many hymns that we can't never catch at all." The old preacher began his sermon by pointing to the dead man who lay on a rude box on the ground before him. "Shum, da-da-dee-da-dum, shum, David, da-da-dee-da-dum. Now I want you all to flee for a moment. Hood ab Adiska's congregation is gwen next to lie, dee-dee-dee-dum. You can't go nowheres, me friends and brothers, they's deaf, and ill find you. You can't dig no hole so deep and bury yourself there, but God Almighty, for sin I survived you, and death will come enter you. You can't go into the big fort, pointing to Hilton Head, and shut yourself up there, there far that Shish Buckner said the dilly couldn't take, they definitely find you there. All your friends may forget you, but definitely never gonna forget you. Now, my brethren, prepare to lie. Diddy diddy dum. This was the burden of the very long sermon, after which the whole congregation went round in a sort of solemn dance called the spiritual shuffle, shaking hands with each other and calling each other by name as they sung. My sister Mary bounced to go. My sister Nanny bounced to go. My brother Tony bouncing to go. My brother July bouncing to go. This is the same tune, till every hand had been shaken by every one of the company. When they came to Harriet, who was a stranger, they sang, "Everybody, advancing to go." The body was then placed in a government wagon, and by the light of the pipe torches, the strange dark procession moved along, singing a rude funeral hymn, till they reached the place of burial. Harriet's account of her interview with an old Negro she met at Hilton Head is amusing and interesting. He said, "I've been here 73 years, working for my master without even a dime wages. I'd work rain, wet, sun, dry. I'd work with my mouth full of dust, but would not stop to get a drink of water. I've been whipped and starved, and I've always been praying, 'Oh Lord, come and deliver us.' All that time, the birds had been flying, and the rabbits had been crying, and the fish had been swimming in these waters. One day I looked up, and I see a big cloud. It didn't come up like the clouds come up further yonder, but it appeared so right overhead. Deer was thunder out of that, and deer was lightning. Then I looked round down in the waters, and I see appeared to me a big house in the water, and out of the big house came great big eggs, and the good eggs went on toward the air, and fell into the fort, and then all the bad eggs burst before they got there. Then the Shabakrik began to run, as the neighbors stopped running, till they get to the swamps, and stick there, and die there. Then I heard the Yankee ships, the Wasabash, frying out of the big eggs, and they had come to set us free. Then I prayed the Lord, He come and put the little finger in the work, and the Shashbakara all go, and the birds stop flying, and the rabbits start crying, and when I go to catch a fish to eat with my rice, there's no fish there. Dear Lord Almighty, come and frighten them all out of the waters. Now praise the Lord, I've prayed 73 years, and now He's coming, and we be free." The last time Harriet was returning from the war, with her pass as a hospital nurse, she brought a half-fare ticket, as she was told she must do, and missing the other train, she got into an immigrant train on the Amboy Railroad. When the conductor looked at her ticket and said, "Come, hustle out of here. We don't carry niggers for half-fare." Harry explained to him that she was an employment of the government and was entitled to transportation as the soldiers were, but the conductor took her forcibly by the arm and said, "I'll make you tired of trying to stay here." She resisted and being very strong, she could probably have got the better of the conductor had he not called three men to his assistance. The car was filled with immigrants, and no one seemed to take her part. The only words she heard, accompanied with fearful oaths, were, "Pitch the nigger out." They nearly wrenched her arm off, and at length threw her with all their strength into a baggage car. She supposed her arm was broken, but in intense suffering, she came on to New York. As she left the car, a delicate-looking young man came up to her and handed her a card, saying, "You ought to sue the conductor, and if you want a witness, call on me." Harriet remained all winter under the care of a physician in New York. He advised her to sue the railroad company, she said, and said that he would willingly testify as to her injuries. But the card the young man had given her was only a visiting card, and she did not know where to find him, so she let the matter go. The writer here finds it necessary to apologize for the very desultory and hasty manner in which this little book is written, being herself pressed for time in the expectation of soon leaving the country, she is obliged to pin down the material to be used in the short and uninterrupted intervals she can obtain from Harriet, and also to use such letters and accounts as may be sent her as they come without being able to work them in the order of time. A very material assistance is to be rendered her by the kind offer of an account of Harriet's services during the war, written by Mr. Charles P. Wood of Auburn, and kindly copied by one of Harriet's most faithful and most efficient friends, Mrs. S. M. Hopkins of that place. It was the wise plan of our sagacious heroine to leave her old parents till the last be brought away. They were pensioned off as too old to work, had a cabin and a horse and a cow, and were quite comfortable. If Harriet had taken them away before the young people, these last would have been sold into southern slavery to keep them out of her way. But at length Harriet heard that the old man had been betrayed by a slave whom he had assisted, but who had turned back, and when questioned by his wife, told her the story of his intended escape and of the aid he had received from Old Ben. This woman, hoping to curry favor with her master, revealed the whole to him, and Old Ben was arrested. He was to be tried the next week. Then Harriet appeared upon the scene, and, as she says, saved him expense the trial, and removed her father to a higher court by taking him off to Canada. The manner of their escape is detailed in the following letter by Thomas Garrett, the Wilmington Quaker. Wilmington, 1868. My friend, thy favor of the 12th reached me yesterday, requesting some reminiscences as I could give respecting the remarkable labors of Harriet Tubman in aiding her colored friends from bondage. I may begin by saying, living as I have in this slave state, and the laws being very severe, where any proof could be made of anyone aiding slaves on the way to freedom, I have not felt at liberty to keep any written word of Harriet's or any labors, except in numbering those whom I have aided. For that reason, I cannot furnish so interesting an account of Harriet's labors as I otherwise could, and now would be glad to do. For in truth, I never met with any person of any color who had more confidence in the voice of God as spoken direct to her soul. She had frequently told me that she talked with God, and he talked with her every day of her life, and she has declared to me that she felt no more fear of being arrested by her former master or by any other person when in his immediate neighborhood than she did in the state of New York or Canada, for she said she never ventured only where God sent her, and her faith in his supreme power truly was great. I have now been confined to my room within disposition more than 4 weeks, and cannot sit to write much, but I feel so much interested in Harriet that I must try to give some of the most remarkable instances that now present themselves to my mind. The date of the commencement of her labors I cannot certainly give, but I think it must have been about 1845. From that time till 1860, I think she must have brought from the neighborhood where she had been held as a slave from 60 to 80 persons from Maryland, some 80 miles from here. No slave who placed himself under her care was ever arrested that I have heard of. She mostly had her regular stopping places on her route, but in one instance when she had two stout men with her, some 30 miles below here, she said that God told her to stop, which she did, and then asked him what she must do. He told her to leave the road and to turn left. She soon obeyed and came to a small stream of tide water. There was no boat, no bridge. She again inquired of her guide what she was to do. She was told to go through. It was cold in the month of March, but having confidence in her guide, she went in, and the water came up to her armpits. The men refused to follow till they saw her safe to the opposite shore. Then they followed, and if I mistake not, she had soon to wade a second stream, soon after which she came to a cabin of colored people who took them all in, put them into bed, and dried their clothes, ready to proceed next morning on the journey. Harriet had run out of money and gave them some of her underclothing to pay for their kindnesses. When she called on me 2 days after, she was so hoarse she could hardly speak and was also suffering from a violent toothache. The strange part of the story we found to be that the master of those two men had put up the previous day at the railroad station near where she left an advertisement for them offering a large reward for their apprehension, but they made a safe exit. She at one time brought as many as 7 or 8, several of whom were women and children. She was well known here in Chester County and in Philadelphia and respected by all true abolitionists. I had been in the habit of furnishing her and those that accompanied her as she returned from her acts of mercy with new shoes, and on one occasion when I had not seen her for 3 months, she came into my store and I said, "Harriet, I am glad to see thee. I suppose thee wants a new pair of shoes." Her reply was, "I want more than that. I in jest said I have always been liberal with thee and wish to be, but I am not rich and cannot afford to give much." Her reply was, "God tells me you have money for me." I asked her if God never deceived her. She said, "No." "Well, how much does thee want?" After studying a moment, she said, "About $23. I then gave her $24 and some odd cents. The net proceeds of £5 sterling received through Eliza Wigham of Scotland for her. I had given some accounts of Harriet's labors to the Anti-Slavery Society of Edinburgh, of which Eliza Wigham was secretary. On the reading of my letter, a gentleman present said he would send Harriet £4 if he knew of any way to get it to her. Eliza Wigham offered to forward it to me for her, and that was the first money ever received by me for her. Some 12 months after, she called on me again and said that God told her that I had some money for her, but not so much as before. I had a few days previous received the net proceeds of £1.10 from Europe for her. To say the least, there was something remarkable in these facts. Whether clairvoyancy or the divine impression on her mind from the source of all powers, I cannot tell, but certain it was she had a guide within herself over than the written word, for she never had any education. She brought away her aged parents into a singular manner. They started with an old horse fitted out in a punitive style with a straw collar, a pair of old chaise wheels with a board on the axle to sit on, another board swung with ropes fastened to the axle to rest their feet on. She got her parents, who were both slaves belonging to different masters, on this rude vehicle to the railroad, put them in the cars, turned on Jehu herself, and drove to town in a style that no human being ever did before or since, but she was happy at having arrived safely. Next day I furnished her with money to take them all to Canada. I afterwards sold their horse and sent them the balance of the proceeds. I believe that Harriet succeeded in freeing all of her relatives, but one sister and 3 children, etc., etc., thy friend, Thomas Garrett. Friend Garrett probably refers here to those who passed through his hands. Harriet was obliged to come by many different routes on her different journeys, and though she never counted those whom she brought away with her, it would seem by the computation of others that there must have been somewhere near 300 brought to her by the Northern States and Canada. Extracts from a letter written by Mr. Sanborn, Secretary of the Massachusetts Board of State Charities. "My dear madam, Mr. Phillips has sent me your note asking for a reminiscence of Harriet Tubman and testimony of her extraordinary story with all her New England friends will, I am sure, be glad to furnish. I never had reason to doubt the truth of what Harriet said in regard to her own career, for I found her singularly truthful. Her imagination is warm and rich, and there is a whole region of the marvelous in her nature which has manifested itself in times remarkably. Her dreams and visions, misgivings and forewarnings ought not to be omitted in any life of hers, particularly those relating to John Brown. She was in his confidence in 1858 to 1859, and he had a great regard for her, which he often expressed to me. She aided him in his plans and expected to do so still further when his career was closed by that wonderful campaign in Virginia. The first time she came to my house in Concord after that tragedy, she was shown into a room in the evening where Brackett's bust of John Brown was standing. The sight of it, which was new to her, threw her into a sort of ecstasy of sorrow and admonition, and she went on in her rhapsody way to pronounce his apotheosis. She had often been in Concord, where she resided at the house of Emerson, Alcott, the Whitneys, the Brooks family, Mrs. Horace Mann, and other well-known persons. They all admired and respected her, and nobody doubted the reality of her adventures. She was too real a person to be suspected. In 1862, I think it was, she went from Boston to Port Royal under the advice and encouragement of Mr. Garrison, Governor Andrew, Dr. Howell, and other leading people. Her career in South Carolina is well known to some of our officers, and I think to Colonel Higginson, now of Newport, Rhode Island, and Colonel James Montgomery of Kansas, to both of whom she was useful as a spy and guide, if I mistake not. I regard her as, on the whole, the most extraordinary person of her race I have ever met. She is a Negro of pure and almost pure blood, can neither read nor write, has the characteristics of her race and condition, but she has done what can scarcely be credited on the best authority, and she has accomplished her purpose with a coolness, foresight, patience, and wisdom, which in a white man would have raised him to the highest pitch of reputation. I am, dear madam, very truly your servant, F.B. Sanborn. Of the dreams and visions mentioned in this letter, the writer might have given many wonderful instances, but it was thought best not to insert anything which, with any, might bring discredit upon the story. When these turns of solemnity come upon Harriet, she imagines that her spirit leaves her body and visits other scenes and places, not only in the world, but in the world of spirits. And her ideas of these scenes show, to say the least of it, a vividness of imagination seldom equaled in the stories of the most cultivated minds. Now, long since, the writer, on going into Harriet's room in the morning, sat down by her and began to read that wonderful and glorious description of the heavenly Jerusalem in the last two chapters of Revelation. When the reading was finished, Harriet burst into a rhapsody which perfectly amazed her hearers, telling of what she had seen in one of those visions, sights which no one could doubt had been real to her, and which no human imagination could have conceived. It would have seemed, unless in dream or vision, there was a wild poetry in these descriptions, which seemed to be border almost on inspiration, but as many that might be characterized as the ravings of insanity. All that can be said is, however, if this woman is insane, there has been a wonderful method in her madness. Leaving off on page 57.